Back again to Bad Quaker Podcast, where liberty is our mission. My name is Ben Stone, and this is for Thursday. Well, today is Thursday, December 27th, 2012, but this will probably be broadcast on Friday, the 28th. And this is podcast number 254. With me today is a very special guest, David Gordon, a senior fellow at the Ludwig von Mises Institute. And he, David Gordon got his PhD in intellectual history. Now, what that means is that he's so smart that he knows the history of smart. Also, he actually taught a course earlier this year, in January of 2012, on how to think. So that'll give you an idea of the kind of a mind we're talking about here. David Gordon, thank you so much for coming on the podcast with me. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Ben. It's very kind of you to invite me, and you've certainly given me a very good introduction, so the rest is going to be an anticlimax, but thanks for the nice introduction anyway.
You have two books that I wanted to mention right off the bat. One of them is The Essential Rothbard. It's a small little book. It's not very expensive. You can set it on your shelf. You can read it in an evening. I think it's something like 200 pages, but it's something that really everybody needs a copy of, The Essential Rothbard, because it's just such a wonderful little book. And then my other favorite of yours is an older book. I think it's like from the late 90s. It's called An Introduction to Economic Reasoning, and it's a great little textbook for homeschoolers, or it's good for somebody who's just being introduced to Austrian economics and really would like to get a step-by-step insight on how to think in a way that is consistent with Austrian economics.
Oh yes, I did write those too. It's very kind of you to mention them. What I was trying to do, actually, the books are connected, because I was trying in the Introduction to Economic Reasoning, it was very much a Murray Rothbard style economics that I was trying to teach. And the important thing, I think, in the Austrian economics is taught by Ludwig von Mises and Murray Rothbard is the very common sense way of looking at the economic system. We just have to learn a few basic principles that are evident once we think about them, and then from that you can get the whole structure of economic theory, so we don't have to go in for all these complicated equations and statistics that you'll find in the mainstream economists. We just use a simple way of analysis, and this will enable us to understand the basis of economic theory.
I think Murray, to a large extent, also used that same simple reasoning as he examined history, and I think he was able to come to some of the historical conclusions that he did because he did use such a simple formula that is so easily adjustable to different things in life.
Well, one thing he did in his historical work, he was very interested in finding out which particular people had benefited by various economic measures, and he would usually look for, say, if there were revolutions or depressions, he'd look for who benefited by particular changes and what were their views on particular questions. So for him, history wasn't a matter of impersonal trends. You know, the Marxists say history is development of the forces of production, but for Murray Rothbard, it was how individuals were responding and changing what came about, and he would particularly look for the influence of economic elite groups. That was one that, say, in American history, was very concerned with banking interests, such as the House of Morgan or the the Rockefellers, and he was also interested in religious movements, so he would always be concerned with particular people and what was driving them.
And Murray's style of writing, too, was such that, you know, not just in the documentation that he would always put with his work, but also just in his way that he would lay it out. It was like he would cover a point thoroughly and completely, and then he would just move on to the next one. He wouldn't just belliger. He wouldn't just belliger a point over and over and over. He would make his point, and then he would move on with it.
He spoke that way, too. He was extremely fast in making connections and things, and he'd expect readers to follow along with him. So a lot of books you find these days, you find the author will say, well, I'm going to be talking about this, and then they say that, and then they have summaries of what they said, so then you'll have highlights of those summaries. But with Murray, it wasn't like that. He would just give you a continuous flow of material, and he'd expect you to be able to see what he was saying and draw the connection. But he didn't write in long, complicated sentences. He had a very simple, straightforward style, but it was a very fast-paced style. You had to keep up with him. You know, I was looking at there was one website I was looking at called Bleeding Heart Libertarians. And they had a number of philosophers were complaining about ethics of liberty and said, oh, he's giving all these bad arguments, he's just making assertions. But they didn't realize, at least the way I look at it, that he does have the arguments, he's just expecting the readers to be able to see how one thing follows from the other, and they obviously weren't able to do that. So I think if you read Rothbard, you have to be prepared to follow along with what he's saying. That was what, in Essential Rothbard, I was trying to help the readers to see some of the key themes, so that might make it a bit easier to see what he was doing.
Let me just interrupt our train of thought here for a second and point out to my listeners what you've probably already realized is that that David has a style of speaking that conveys a gentle intelligence, and you know, his wording, as you can tell by what you've just heard, his voice is so calm and gentle that and one of the things that I've really enjoyed listening to David Gordon over the years is his lectures at the Mises Institute. I've spent hours and hours in my garden with an MP3 player stuck into my ear, listening to David speaking. And one of the things, and he did it in today's podcast, by the way, one of the things he always does in his lectures that I've seen is he always introduces humor right in the very beginning, and that kind of disarms the listener, and it also sort of puts a comfort level between the listener and the lecturer. And I always wanted to have the opportunity, David, to tell you that I appreciate that, and I really appreciate your style of humor. It's you have a very unique method of getting to the punchline, and that I've always enjoyed that. I know that's completely off the topic of what we were talking about there, but I always thought that if I had the opportunity, I wanted to tell you that.
Oh, well, that's very nice of you to say that, Ben. You know, I must say, well, you say my voice is very much a minority view. I've been described as sounding like Droopy Dog on sleeping pills. I wouldn't make a good radio announcer, I can tell you that. But I do try to put in a few jokes. Sometimes my jokes have gotten me into trouble, but you know, I try to keep, you have to tell academic jokes, you know, in lectures, you know, like there was a great friend of mine, Jim Sadowski, who was also a friend of Murray Rothbard, the philosophy professor at Fordham. So one he had, I always liked this one, he said, the word philosophy comes from the Greek word philosophia, which means philosophy.
I don't know if you recall this one or not, but you had a joke that just broke me up that was about, I think it was an economist and somebody else and somebody else, two other sciences, are stranded on a desert island and they're starving and there's a case of cans of food and they're contemplating how to get to the cans of food and coming up with different solutions.
Let me see. I remember one where there was one where I think let me see if I forgot this. So there's a, well, there's one where there's a physicist who says something like, what we can do is try to, it's something that we can heat up some, how does this one go? It's skipping my mind. I think the way it ends up is that the economist says, assume a can opener, I think. But I'm forgetting the first part of it. Is that the one you're thinking of? I've heard a joke like that. I'm not sure. Are you sure it's what? It's one of mine. I mean, the one I do like on, I remember Jan Narveson, who's a very good philosopher, libertarian philosopher, once said to me, an economist is someone who doesn't have the personality to be an accountant.
That's pretty good. I was going to ask you about him anyway. That was in my notes. Well, let's see. How do I build up to this? You had you do a lot of book reviews, and one time you referred to book reviews as being a blood sport.
Oh, yes, yes, that's very true. I was quoting Jacob Neusner there, who's done an enormous number. I mean, I always say in book reviews, if you can't say something bad about a book, why say it at all? Although I have done some favorable ones. Sometimes, you know, you're forced to do that if the book is good, but it's much better if you can find something bad and really let the author have it.
And that in contrast to your, like I was talking about your gentle speaking style, your book reviews can sting sometimes, but that's good.
Oh, yes, I believe, you know, Colonel Dwight MacDonald once did a review of a book that came out in World War II. It was on military, unarmed self-defense for military people. It was called Kill or Get Killed. So he summarized this book. He said, always kick below the belt, especially when the other man is down. So I think that's what you have to do in a good negative book review.
You took a bit of heat not long ago. You reviewed one of Stefan Molyneux's books, and and I can say that safely on this podcast because I've run off most of the rabid Stefan followers. But you took quite a bit of heat for your comments on that. I read through both of it. I was comfortable both ways. But
Oh yes. Well, what happened there? You see, I just come across. Someone sent me this and said he'd done a short book on ethics, very short, and said, would I look at this? And I wasn't really familiar with him. I knew he was a broadcaster, and I'd seen some of his stuff. I didn't agree with the certain things, like his seemed to be anti-family, or rather, I didn't think his views on religion were very good, but I hadn't really encountered him very much. So I read the thing, I thought it was just terrible, so I said that. I really didn't like it. I thought he just made all sorts of mistakes. And it turned out he has quite a lot of followers, and they tend to think very highly of him, so they were really letting me have it. I mean, one person called me a jackass, and another one said I look like a pedophile. And then he had various of his followers. But it seemed to me that he and the followers really didn't grasp the arguments at all. I mean, the one statement I regret in my original review, I said, well, he's not stupid. I think he's just has a kind of a facile intelligence. But if I had to write the review over, I'd take that out. I mean, I think he is pretty stupid when you come down to it. I mean, he does speak in a very eloquent manner, and but I mean, he's something like a trained parrot, if you ask me, or even if you don't, for that matter. I mean, his followers kept saying, would I debate him? I mean, I wouldn't want to do that. I mean, would be I have no more interest in doing that than debating a clown.
Oftentimes, debates are more based on, yeah, you know, presentation and vocal qualities and how good you can march around and impress people with your, you know, appearance.
Oh yes. Well, I think his, you know, when I hear, I heard a few of, or parts of a few of his YouTube presentations, he's certainly a much better speaker than I am, which isn't saying much. But I think, you know, I listening to him, I think of what Disraeli, I think, said about someone in 1871 in a campaign speech. He said that this person he was talking with was inebriated by the exuberance of his own verbosity, and I think that's very true of Molyneux.
You mentioned Narveson a moment ago. Let's give the listeners a kind of idea of what Jan Narveson, what his work is about, and what he kind of stands for, because he also talks a lot about ethics and that kind of thing.
Oh, yes. Well, I think very highly of Jan Narveson. He's a Canadian philosopher. He started off as a utilitarian in his career. He got his PhD at Harvard, but then he changed and he now adopts somewhat sort of a social contract view of ethics. So what he basically says is how do we determine what the proper rules of ethics are? Say we find in contemporary society, say some people favor the free market, others are socialists, we have various views on what the government should do. So how do we settle questions like that? So he said, well, we could imagine people trying to come to an agreement. And what he thinks they would, they, since they have these differing views, they would try to agree on the minimum possible terms. Like we'd have laws, so we'd agree that we wouldn't want to kill each other, allow theft. So we'd have the minimum possible rules, and this would get you to a libertarian view rather than more expanded state, because that would be a very controversial position. Some people wouldn't accept that, but everyone would accept that we need basic laws against theft and murder, aggression. So he thinks the libertarian view was kind of the natural point at which people could reach an agreement. And in his view, that's the basis of morality. Now, I don't know whether that covers all morality, but I think it is a very good way of looking at least part of the morality that covers political life. I gave him a very favorable review. I had a book called The Libertarian Idea. I reviewed that, I think, for recent papers, and then he's had some later ones. But I think I rate him very highly.
We need to break for commercial about now, and when we get back, we'll have more with David Gordon, so stick with us for about 60 seconds.
Do you have an Amazon account? If you don't, let me encourage you to set one up. Setting up an account is free and it's easy. Amazon has great prices, and in most cases, you can avoid paying sales tax. Plus, if you're careful and lump your purchases together, you can even get free shipping. And Amazon has almost anything you can think of. Plus, it's safer and cheaper than driving all over town. When you buy stuff, if you follow the Amazon link at badquicker.com, Amazon will give badquicker.com a tiny portion of the purchase price. It won't cost you any extra, but you will be supporting this podcast. Thank you.
Thanks for sticking with us through the break. My name is Ben Stone with Bad Quicker Podcast, and with me is David Gordon of the Mises Institute. David, before the break, we were talking about Jan Narveson. Could you compare Herbert Spencer, because I knew Herbert Spencer, you know, I knew a little bit about him and so forth, but one of your lectures where you talked about John Stuart Mill, Lysander Spooner, and Herbert Spencer really got my attention to Herbert Spencer and put him on my radar. Could you talk a little bit about Herbert Spencer and maybe the difference between he and Narveson?
Oh, well, Spencer was one of the great British philosophers of the 19th century. He was also one of the founders of sociology. He's probably, when people think of Spencer, they probably associate the phrase social Darwinism with him, but that doesn't really describe his views too much. He did believe in kind of an evolutionary process for development, society development. Basic idea he had, which was in his social statics, was he started with individuals having rights. He had what he called a law of equal freedom. And he thought that things would work out for the general interest if each person had individual rights and property. So like John Stuart Mill, he was a utilitarian in the sense he was asking what will have the best consequences. But he thought there were general rules that, if they were followed, would lead to the best consequences. And these rules would be having individuals who would have individual rights, and you'd have the individuals would deal with each other on a peaceful basis. And he was very critical of legislation that in his time had moved away from individualism. He thought that there'd been a tendency, in British history, there'd been a movement first in an individualist direction, but then in the 19th century, there'd been a tendency to rely on the government to solve certain problems. Let's say people say, well, we can't have just individuals taking care of their own health. We need to have government sanitation departments. We need to have the government take over. And Spencer was very much against this, and he thought that was a reversion to the type of policy he opposed. So he thought that with an individualist society that would lead to peace and prosperity. He was also very strongly against war. He thought that war and militarism were very dangerous things. He was opposed to the British at that time, where you know, the British Empire was the largest in the world, and he was very much against the British colonialism and imperialism.
He's been Herbert Spencer has been often mistranslated as being somewhat cruel, and sometimes libertarians have sort of inherited this myth that we're all cruel and that we would just let people die, and that even that Herbert Spencer sort of presented that as a positive thing, that the poor people and the sick people and so forth, they should sort of drop out as part of a Darwinist type, thinning of the herd, so to speak. But he really didn't believe that, did he?
No. In fact, he thought that voluntary charity was a very good thing, and he said people naturally sympathize with other people, so we would tend to help those who were not doing well. Now, what he did think was that when, say, you have a measure to a social welfare measure, you do have to take account of the effects on the people and whether you want these effects to take place. For example, supposing you have a program where you give money to people who are unemployed, that will reduce the incentive that people have to work, because they'll think, well, even if I don't have a job, I'm still going to be getting money. So you would have to ask, if you favor that program, do you want that effect? Are you willing to put up with that effect? So I think Spencer was right, called attention to these things. He said, well, look, if you have government aid to the poor, then this is a way of increasing the number of poor people. And that was, I think, the basis for the claims that he was a social Darwinist, but he certainly didn't oppose voluntary charity, just opposed to having the government do it. And in his book, The Man Versus the State, he's very clear. He just said, well, you know, you should just investigate, be very careful when you're giving money, what the effects are. But I mean, he didn't favor that getting rid of poor people. He thought everyone had individual rights, and he was very opposed to war and militarism, you know, which is the way people get killed after all. So he was really someone who supported individual survival rather than oppose it. Now, the notion of social Darwinism really became popular in the book published, I think, after World War II by the Columbia historian Richard Hofstadter, called Social Darwinism in American Thought. So that's really the most influential book in having this notion that people who favor the free market are really believing this kind of dog-eat-dog philosophy, where it's the rich or the good people, and then the poor are the ones who are just dropped by the wayside. But that's certainly not something Spencer held. There were people in Europe who had kind of a view of Darwinian struggle, and they favored war as a means of advancing that. But I say that was certainly not Spencer's view. I mean, there were people like Ludwig Gumplow that had kind of an impossible sounding name, but he thought that there was kind of a process of struggle in history based with kind of a Darwinian process. I mean, you get elements of that even, you know, in this is one thing, if you look at Hitler's speeches, he thought that also kind of their nations are in a kind of a biological struggle with each other, although he didn't take that particularly from Darwin, but from other German writers who thought that.
I think maybe Herbert Spencer was the victim of what Bastiat described, where, you know, Bastiat says that if we say, you know, government shouldn't supply to the arts, shouldn't support the arts, then somehow we're against the arts, or you know, the reverse of that.
Oh, yes, that's a very good point. I mean, people say, well, if you don't favor welfare state, you must really hate the poor, but in fact, it's the free market that'll best promote the poor. When you mentioned Bastiat, you know, that was actually the law by Bastiat, was the first libertarian publication I read, which I read in, when I was in junior high in around 1962. So I always like to hear people mention Bastiat.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Bastiat. I you know, his of course it's coming into English through translation, but his way of laying out logic just seems so pure. I wish I could have found him in junior high.
Oh yeah, so you you became acquainted with libertarianism later, or?
Well, I think I kind of I was natural to it in my late teens. I had a natural repulsion of authority, especially, you know, unjustified authority that was just imposed upon me, not necessarily. There were older people that I respected and admired their authority and so forth, but I had always had an aversion to top-down imposed authority, and so I kind of was already predisposed toward an anarchical type libertarian thinking, but I just wish I would have. Mm-hmm. I just wish I would have had something, you know, laid out like that, like Bastiat or like Rothbard or so forth.
Oh yeah, yes, I was very lucky to have come across these writers very early. I think I just went to a particular bookstore called Poor Richard's Bookstore. It was on Hollywood Boulevard in Los Angeles. And they had all these books there, so I just started reading them. I read Murray Rothbard, Man, Economy, and State that year, Human Action. So I really liked them. And I'm afraid, you know, I'm very stubborn. Once I hold some view, I don't change it. And I had those views in the, I've kept those views for, it's been 50 years since then. I still have the same views.
Let's talk about Murray a little bit. You were personal friends with Murray.
Oh, yes, yes, I knew him very well, yes. Yes, he was a wonderful person.
I never had the opportunity to meet him, but from what everything that everybody has ever said that I've heard about him that were actually close to him, they were always amazed at the level of intelligence of the man and his wide scope of the things that he knew about, everything from soap operas to sports to, you know, history and economics.
Oh yes, that's very true. I mean, he was certainly one of his areas was German Baroque art, which you wouldn't expect that from an economist, but that was one of them. I mean, anything you asked him, he would know. I remember one story, I was telling him, I like the trivia question. I was telling Murray, I was talking to my friend Mel Bradford, who was a professor at the University of Dallas, who was very good on American history. I managed to trap him. I asked him, Bradford, what was Rutherford Hayes' middle name? And I was telling Murray this story about Bradford, so Murray said, it was Burchard, of course.
Murray would know that.
Yeah. Yeah, when I remember once, one of the first times I went to the program put on by the Cato Institute, it was in June 1979 in Eugene, Oregon. I remember a student asked him something, so Murray said, yes, there's an unpublished dissertation in New York University on this point. So anything you asked me would just give you all sorts of references, and he'd always know this. And I mean, he'd be very good in a great many different fields, not just economics, history, but philosophy, political science. And of course, he knew movies. He reviewed, he did movie reviews under the name Mr. First Snyder, and he'd always have good things. He was very good on literature also. So he was really a tremendous scholar.
I think it's interesting that he would be a movie that he would do movie reviews. That's something that probably most people who have read a lot of Murray's stuff would be a little shocked at.
Well, he was very good on that. I mean, he didn't like the kind of the modernistic and avant-garde movies too much, but he would be very interested. But when he'd go to movies, he'd sometimes say things or start talking out loud.
Theater?
I mean, he'd been known to do that.
He was, the first Murray Rothbard book that I bumped into was at a garage sale, and it was one of the books in the series. It jumped out of my head.
Conceived in Liberty.
Yeah, exactly. And all I had, I think it was the third in the series. And that was the only one I had. I picked it up at the garage sale for like 50 cents or something like that. And this was about 1980, I'm going to say 81 or 82, something like that. And it just blew me away. I couldn't find any other material by him locally where I lived at. I couldn't find any references to him in the library. And I just had to assume that he was some obscure historian that was, you know, squirreled away in some attic somewhere of some, some cathedral or something, just writing history. I had no idea he was even an economist.
Oh, yes. Well, that was one he did. It was on, there were four, actually, I think there's a done part of a fifth long that it was in manuscript, but I don't think it ever came out. But that was on the American colonial period and leading to the American Revolution. So he was dealing with this all from an individualist point of view, you know, and he was going into enormous details on each of the colonies. So he had, you know, a lot of historians will say, for example, that after the American Revolution, well, the Articles of Confederation, the government was too weak, so then they had to strengthen it with the Constitution. Now, Rothbard goes the other way. He said, well, the Articles of Confederation went too far. That was too centralized. So he takes a reverse perspective from most of the historians who've written on that. And you can see, if you read the book, he has bibliographies covering all the major sources. He read a great deal. And that was just one area he worked in, and one of many. So he just had a tremendous knowledge. I remember it was always fun going in bookstores with him. You know, he'd just go in, and you go along the different shelves and just give comments on all the books that he knew. I used to go to Strand Bookstore with him. That's in Manhattan. That was one of his favorites. Barnes & Noble Sale Annex was another one he liked.
Now, sort of shifting gears again, you had the opportunity to actually sit in a classroom and listen to F.A. Hayek.
Oh, yes, that's right. Yes, that was in 1969. He was a visiting professor at UCLA, and I was a senior then. I took Hayek for Philosophy of the Social Sciences.
He had a method of lecturing that was quite unique, I think. He didn't use notes, did he?
No.
Didn't he just take it off the cuff?
Yes. And the thing that was unusual was his lectures would be very polished. You could print what he said, and he just spoke in very very long sentences, and they'd be all carefully thought out. But he didn't use notes. He would be commenting on something we wanted us to read, and he'd usually have criticisms of it, and he'd have the book that he was criticizing open. He used to smoke these little cigars, and he'd flick the ashes onto the page while he was commenting. In those days, you know, I guess, of course, smoking's gone out now. In those days, people still do it. You know, it was like the story of the man who read so much about how bad smoking is for your health that he gave up reading.
Murray's method of lectures was quite different, though. He, he was very... fun. I don't know if that is that the right way to describe his lectures?
Yeah, I mean, he was very sort of rapid fire, and he kind of make comments to himself while he was lecturing, and he was very funny. And people liked it. A lot of people did imitations of him, but he was very good on imitations himself of different people. Like he did do Mayor LaGuardia of New York, but he didn't like imitations of himself all that much, but lots of people have done them.
His ability to interject humor into almost everything was one of his strengths as well.
Yes, he liked when you were around him, you'd always be laughing, always have some funny angle on things. Like I remember he was talking about one revisionist historian, M.H. Cochran. He had some story that the man had he did a book called Germany Not Guilty in 1914, which was a criticism of a book by Bernadotte Schmidt. So after that book was a very good book, he kind of went off his rocker, and he burned down a house he was living with. So Murray liked to tell this story that this was one of Harry Elmer Barnes's proteges, and look what happened to him.
I think we ought to break again for another commercial, and I'll save this file. We'll be right back in about 60 seconds. Stick with us, folks.
BadQuaker.com uses HostGator as our web hosting service. It was fast and easy to set up, and the support we receive is top-notch. They have a helpful and friendly 24/7, 365 live technical support and a 99.9% uptime guarantee. And they have some of the best prices in the business. If you have a website or if you want to have a website, check them out by going to badquaker.com first. Click the button for HostGator. And thank you for supporting badquaker.com.
Thanks for sticking with me through that break. And this is Ben Stone with Bad Quaker, back with David Gordon from the Mises Institute. And we were talking about Rothbard, about Murray Rothbard. And David, you've got a series coming up at the Mises Institute. It was one of the reasons why I got a hold of you and wanted you to come on the show with me. Series is called Rothbard, A Life Lived for Liberty. It costs $59, and it's a six-week course. And that's from January 8th to February 18th. And I want to highly recommend this to folks. Describe, David, how how the series goes, how it takes place.
Oh, well, it's very kind of you to mention my course. This is put on by the Mises Academy, which is online program of online teaching. And what happens if you enroll in the course, you get access to the website, and every week there's I give a lecture, and the students will see me on their video. You get a video, it's done through computer, and you see me on the computer screen, and also you listen to the talk. And then while I'm lecturing, you can type in comments and questions, and I don't hear what the students are saying, but I can see the questions. And I give a lecture for about an hour, and then there's about half hour for discussion and questions. And then the students have, if you enroll, you have access to this at any time. You don't have to come just at the time I'm giving the live lecture. You can access the course anytime you want. I usually give weekly quizzes also. Those are very easy, just if you want to take them. So I like doing this. This will be my 18th course for the Mises Academy. And what I'm going to do in the course, I'm going to give an introduction to the major things that Murray wrote about. I'm going to talk about his life, what he did in economic theory, political philosophy, history. So I think if you take the course, you'll good grounding in some of the basic themes of Rothbard's thought, and that'll, you'll be able to go on to further reading in him. And, you know, it's not very much money, $59, a bargain at half the price.
And actually it is. If you consider what, you know, what a 6-week course would cost in most situations, $59, that's pretty cheap.
Oh, yeah. Yes, I mean, some of the courses I've gotten a lot of students, you know, it varies very much with the topic, but I'm hoping we'll get some students, and I'm hoping there's a lot of interest in Rothbard's life and activities. He certainly did an enormous amount. He wrote and published so much, and he was always giving talks. And, well, I'll tell you one funny story. His wife, Joey Rothbard, was also a very remarkable person. So I remember once it was at the, he had come down in 1979 to Los Angeles. There was a Libertarian Party convention at the Bonaventure Hotel. And there was one lady, I won't mention her name, but she had a Libertarian supper club. And she asked Murray to give a talk for her club. So Joey was talking to me afterwards, and she said, you know what Murray got for that talk? Zip.
I shouldn't say nobody, but typically people don't talk about Murray's wife that much. It's just kind of, you know, he was such an outstanding character that he kind of took the whole stage. But I'm imagining in my mind it must have taken a very special person to have the kind of humor that it would take to put up with somebody like Murray on a 24/7 basis. Somebody that with that kind of a mind, it would just wear you out to be around him all the time.
Well, you see, she was very smart herself. She had they met at Columbia University when they're both students, and she was very, I think she was extremely bright and kept up with him. She typed his manuscripts, and they were very much in love with each other, and they got along. She had one of her big, one thing she did, you know, there would always be people who wanted to talk to Murray, and she had to kind of make sure that the wrong people didn't get to Murray. She would always kind of keep things in order. She had very strong views on all the people associated with Murray. She didn't like everybody, but she did like most of them, but I mean, she had very definite likes and dislikes, and she had a very good sense of humor. She would be very good on comebacks and good remarks.
So she would kind of play the part of his agent then, to sort of filter.
Yes. I mean, he would value her opinions and advice on people. And she almost always, I think, or practically always, maybe always, had very good judgment on people. Certain ones that she said she didn't like were ones that Murray later broke with, and turned out she was right. I better not mention any names. Be in too much trouble.
Yeah, we've probably already upset the Stefan Molyneux people. We don't want to upset other characters as well.
Yes, that's okay. I'll just mention one. There's one very prominent libertarian, been around forever, Leonard Liggio. You probably know him. He's president of the Mont Pelerin Society and the Philadelphia Society is a group, kind of a conservative group. I think the one rule of their society is they never meet in Philadelphia. Joey wasn't too, he was at one time in very close to Murray, but Joey wasn't too fond of him. And then Murray and Leonard did have a breakup after around 1990. So he came around to her point of view, but she was very much against him.
Now, Murray, you mentioned the Cato Institute a minute ago, and I think a lot of people don't realize that in the early days of the Cato Institute, that was basically Murray's, Murray's little project there that he had going. And you'd never know that if you went to their building now and walked around in there. You know, there's no indication of it. But that was one of his pet projects, wasn't it?
Oh, yes. Well, see, when it was really founded by... when Charles Koch founded it, it was really to promote Murray Rothbard's ideas. He, at that time, was very close to Rothbard. So when they set up the Cato Institute, it was supposed to be a way of promoting Rothbardian ideas, but of course it's changed a lot. Now, incidentally, people will sometimes say, well, the Koch brothers, you know, Charles and David Koch, but it was really Charles Koch was the key person there. David Koch was very much in his brother's shadow. I remember Ralph Rako was supposed to once said about David Koch, he's the dumbest white man I ever met. So, and it's really, when you talk about the Koch brothers, it's really Charles Koch is the one you need to think about.
That may be the funniest thing I've heard in a while.
Ralph Rako, I should mention, he's one of Murray Rothbard's closest friends. I mean, I'll tell you a couple stories about, there were two very close friends of Murray Rothbard, Ralph Rako and Ronald Hamaway, who were probably the two funniest people I've ever met. Now, Hamaway, unfortunately, died not that long ago, but they would come up with, I'll just give you one sentence, that most of the stuff they said you wouldn't be able to print, but I'll give you a sample. Like, once I was at a conference in 1980 at Albany University, it was on Thought of Thomas Sott, so I was sitting in the bar with Ralph, and we saw this very tough-looking man at the other end of the bar. So Ralph, you know, had this very kind of a New York accent, said, hey, why don't you go up to that guy and say to him, what are you going to do for a face when King Kong wants his ass back? And the story about Hamaway is that Hamaway and Ralph, Ron Hamaway and Ralph, had once gone to a fast food restaurant in New York, and after they'd finished, Hamaway had a kind of very slow way of sarcastic delivery, and Hamaway said, this is the best meal I've had since Thanksgiving dinner at Auschwitz. They always come up with remarks like that. And if you got them together with Murray, you couldn't stop laughing.
That's his restaurant critics' capabilities are as sharp as some of your book reviews. Then,
oh yeah, Hamaway. Yeah, he would. He's probably the most sarcastic person I've ever met. I mean, he would really. What was one he used to say? One time I remember I was at a bookstore in Berkeley with him, and he paid by credit card, which at that time, of course, people had credit cards. It wasn't the ordinary thing it is now. So the sales clerk said, well, this is all right, but personally, I just use credit cards in emergencies. And so Ronald said, this is an emergency. I have to rush this book to a hospital immediately.
If we shift gears and go back to a series that you did earlier this year at the Mises Institute, similar to the one that you're going to do on Rothbard in a couple weeks, you did one earlier this year on how to think. I mentioned that in the intro, and that was it was about how to use critical thinking and logic, and how to avoid the basic logical flaws that we tend to fall into. And you've also done some work on pointing that out with economics, how to avoid the common flaws that we face in economics.
Oh yeah, yes, I think this is very important. And in economic thinking like we've seen issues that sometimes we can settle things through very commonsensical principles, like, say, if we're thinking, well, should we have protective tariffs? Well, you just have to realize when you're making an exchange with somebody, you say you go down to the store and buy something, the exchange couldn't take place unless both people expected to benefit from it. If, say, you go down to the store to buy some food, you obviously want what you're buying more than the money, and the person in the store would rather have the money than what he's selling you. So that's a very simple principle, but it doesn't change in international trade either. So, you know, if you're trading with a foreign country, both parties are expecting to benefit, and so protective tariff then is just imposing a barrier to people increasing their welfare. So it's a very simple argument, but once you grasp it, then you can see what is wrong with the tariff policy.
Back during the months of the run-up to the last election, there was a lot of talk among the candidates, not Ron Paul, but the other candidates, the status candidates, we could say, about how China was cheating in trade, and how China needed to be punished for their cheating in trade and cheating in monetary policy. And I kept thinking, you know, that on the surface, that just sounds goofy. But then the more you think about it, the more goofy it sounds.
Oh, yeah, yes, I mean, it is. I mean, if they're cheating was apparently giving us goods at lower prices than others, I mean, that's to the, presumably, you know, if you, when, say, we mentioned earlier, you'd gone into a garage sale and found Rothbard's Conceived in Liberty, the third volume for 50 cents, well, you wouldn't have, that would have, it's better for you, say, if the price were $500, you wanted, when you're buying something, you want to have it at a low price, and so this applies in trade also. If the Chinese are giving us low price goods, this is not a bad thing, but it's a good thing.
Yeah, and as far as the Chinese monetary policy, you know, accusing them of, you know, of overproducing their money, when that's what the Federal Reserve does for a living, it seemed kind of odd to me.
Oh yes. I mean, the whole inflationary policy was monetary policy is one thing Rothbard was very firmly against. You know, you should look at that early pamphlet. Everybody should read it. It's called "What Has Government Done to Our Money?" That gives you kind of basics of Rothbard's approach to money. Where in a free market, money is just a commodity, almost always gold or silver, but it's just a commodity. It isn't a separate thing controlled by the government.
There's a lot of confusion. I had actually thought this had been put to rest about a year ago, and I didn't give you any warning that I was going to throw this at you, so I apologize ahead of time. But I'm sure you're familiar with the greenbackers and their theories of money production and so forth.
Oh, yes. Well, see, they make a basic mistake, which is money, which is this, that money is not like other goods in that, say, other goods, say, generally speaking, the more you have of the good, the better, as long as people still want it. Like, say, the more if automobiles you have, the better, you know, people can buy them more cheaply. But money is different because aside from the non-monetary use of if you have a, say, gold standard, you can use gold for other purposes. What the use of money is to buy all the other goods. So increasing the number of monetary units doesn't add to wealth because you're using the money to buy the various goods and services. So if the goods and services don't increase, all you've got is more units to buy the same thing, so the value will decrease of each unit. It is so what the greenbackers think is, oh, well, if you just give people, print up more money, that's kind of there's an artificial scarcity of money. If you just printed up more money, this would, they'd say, oh, they have all these private bankers who are just controlling the money supply for their own benefit. If you just increase the supply of money, then you'll promote prosperity, but it wouldn't have that effect. It would just, you would not be increasing wealth at all. You just, it, you know, if you, on that theory, we could, you know, on the greenback theory, well, why don't we just print up $1 billion for each person so we'd all be billionaires? If you can see it, it just wouldn't work. Sometimes that's a very good technique and logic. If you're trying to think of an argument, just say, well, what would happen if you really apply this principle to the full, more than the advocates want, then you can see what's wrong with it. You know, say, well, a minimum wage law, well, why don't we have a minimum wage of $10,000 an hour if minimum wage laws help workers? So sometimes you can see what's wrong with the program just by extending the proposal beyond what the advocates say, and then you'll see the basic fallacy more easily.
One of the problems that the greenbackers get into also is they're very worried about bankers making interest off of loans, and a lot of the greenbackers are really against interest. But Murray Rothbard did a lot of work on showing that really interest in a loan is just a matter of time preference.
Yeah, that's right. In the Austrian view, Mises had this. Interest reflects the fact that we prefer to have a goods at present to the future, in the near future to the far future. So again, interest is not an artificial scarcity created by the banking monopoly. You know, I find that it's interesting you mentioned this, because I was reviewing a book, a quite good book by Gary Chartier, who's a left libertarian. He was a bit influenced by these people, say, oh, well, if we had in a free libertarian society, we'd have all these extra mutual banks and we'd be able to have more credit. And this wouldn't be desirable at all. We'd just be increasing the money supply, and that doesn't promote prosperity at all. You know, basically, Austrian business cycle theory is, if you expand credit when it's not backed by actual goods and services, it'll just create an unsustainable boom. So the notion that the interest is something like reflects some kind of artificial scarcity of capital is completely wrong. It's actually, you find some of that same view in Lord Keynes and some of the other monetary 20th century monetary cranks like Silvio Gesell and Major Douglas, people like that. They thought, well, you know, get rid of interest, everything will be all right. But I mean, interest is essential for allocating capital between present and future goods.
It's practically like the price of money, if you look at it that way.
Yes. Interest, yeah, is the more what you pay for the use of money, yeah.
David, we've run out of time, but I really want to thank you for coming on the show with me and for taking the time out of your schedule to do this, especially, you know, this time of year. A lot of people are wanting to spend more time with the family or taking time off or whatever, but I really appreciate you coming on the show with me, and I want to extend an invitation for any time in the future that you want to come on. Just drop me a note and I'll get you on here.
Oh, well, thanks for inviting me, Ben. It's been a great pleasure being on your show, and thanks for all your nice comments. And I hope to be on your show again sometime.
Thanks for listening to the Bad Quaker podcast today, and be sure and get to badquaker.com, where liberty is our mission. Thanks a lot, folks.